Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. From now on, the session will be in English. And I'm Yoshi Nakai. I teach Chinese politics at Gakushin University. My main duty today is let the conference going and keep the time. We have three distinguished experts on this field. The first speaker is Ms. Oksana Antonenko. And she is a senior fellow of Russia and the Eurasia Program and the International Institute for Strategic Studies, IISS. She oversees all IISS work on Russia, Central Asia, South Caucasus, and Western NIS states. And her recent report is called Putin's Dilemmas. Well, it sounds really interesting. And second speaker is Professor Mark Katz. And he is a professor of government and politics at the George Mason University. And his current research is focused on Russian foreign policy. And his recent publication is Rapprochement Finally Possible? And Transnational Revolutionary Ideologies. Third speaker is Professor Akihiro Iwashita. He's a professor at Hokkaido University. And his field of specialization is international relations, with the main focuses on Russian foreign policy and Sino-Russian relations. His recent book in Japanese about the Northern Territories received the Osaragi Jiro Award. So he's a rich man now. So let's begin with the first speaker, Ms. Oksana. Oksana, please.
Thank you very much. I would like to start by thanking the organizers, the Sasakawa Peace Foundation, for organizing this symposium and in generally for supporting a lot of very valuable work on Eurasian studies and Eurasian confidence-building measures and academic exchanges that were taking place in Central Asia. Sasakawa Peace Foundation supported one of the conferences on SCO, which we have organized in London, and I think that is still considered to be one of the most authoritative academic conferences on the issue in Europe, and I think it raised a lot of interest towards SCO in Europe. The second point I want to say, of course, I also would like to thank Professor Iwashita, who is doing a lot of work on SCO and for inviting us to the symposium. Secondly, I would like to emphasize what Professor Iwashita said in his introductory remarks, that my comments today are very much comments of an expert, and they do not represent either the views of IISS or the views of the European Union. However, I hope that they do reflect in the thrust the key trends that are now taking place in relationship between Europe and Central Asia, and Europe and SCO in particular. I will structure my presentation in the next 20 minutes around four main topics. The first topic I would like to touch on will be, in general, how the European Union now views Central Asia. Secondly, I would like to speak about why the SCO is important for the European Union. Thirdly, I would like to look at the limitations that the European Union and SCO face in developing their dialogue, or their cooperation, hopefully. And the fourth issue will be looking at the practical ideas and recommendations on how this cooperation can be structured and around which themes it can develop in the future. When we debated the topic of today's symposium, there was a lot of email exchange between organizers and us. We were wondering how it should be called. And I think it ended up being called a partnership. Of course, it is very much aspirational partnership. I think we're still very far from seeing a partnership between European Union and SCO to develop. So if one can add the word possible partnership, I think that will reflect more clearly the realities on the ground today. So what is the EU policy in Central Asia? As you know, probably in the end of June this year, European Union, European Council has passed for the first time a new comprehensive strategy on Central Asia. This is a really significant development that in some ways has not been maybe noticed very much in Europe, because the last EU summit was known very much on negotiations around the new EU treaty. But in fact, I think the passage of this new strategy on Central Asia signifies an enormous success, I think, an enormous shift forward in the European foreign policy or aspiration to a common European foreign policy. Central Asia, which is not the region bordering with the European Union, is now getting much more attention in Brussels and, of course, in many of the European capitals. In fact, under the German presidency, Central Asia has been declared as one of the three key priorities for the EU presidency, something which has not happened ever in the EU history. The German foreign minister, speaking before the EU summit, has emphasized the three main interests for the EU in Central Asia, which were guiding this decision on priority. The first issue, of course, is Central Asia's strategic location, primarily bordering on Afghanistan and, of course, having influence on the future stability in the region. Secondly, there is an issue of region's struggle, in his words, Steinmeier's words, so far successful in containing Islamic extremism and fundamentalism in Central Asia. And the third issue, of course, is Central Asia's vast energy resources, which are increasingly important for Europe in context of new concerns about European energy security. So what does the new EU strategy for Central Asia mean? There are a number of new realities in EU policy. Firstly, the EU policy will be much more nuanced than it was in the past. In 1990s, the European Union has spent more than 1 billion euros on Central Asia. However, the EU footprint or EU profile in Central Asia has been very marginal, one can argue, definitely much more marginal than many other regional players in the region. Now, there is a much more commitment to treat European Union seriously and also to develop a more nuanced bilateral policies, emphasizing that each of the Central Asian states is different and requires a different approach. There will be also more funding from the European Union towards Central Asia. In fact, a very substantial increase in funding in the next several years, which will be not in the form of technical assistance, as it was in 1990s, but a developed bilateral programs that will be very comprehensive in nature and cover a number of important areas from economics to energy to education and other issues. And finally, the EU is now openly prepared, and it is declared in the strategy, to enter into a dialogue with a number of regional organizations that are now active in Central Asia. And of course, in this context, SCO has been specifically mentioned as one of the potential partners with which European Union wants to engage in the discussions in the future. So why is the SCO important for the European Union? Of course, SCO is still relatively little known in Europe. However, I will argue that SCO over time has developed into a very dynamic, influential, and ambitious regional organization, which is now stretching all across not only Central Asia, but covers almost the entire Asian continent. Of course, you know that not only the members, but if we look at the observers in the SCO, which now include India, Pakistan, and Iran, and aspiring observers. We had a number of other countries that are interested to join, like, for example, Nepal or a number of other regional states, Bangladesh, etc. So we will see a greater expansion, I think, possibly of SCO further into the Asian continent. So it is certainly a very important institution. SCO, of course, is important for the EU first and foremost because it has an enormous potential of playing a role in the regional economic development. And that is, of course, what European Union has been interested in ever since it arrived in Central Asia after the end of the Soviet Union. Although SCO has been known more as a political and military institution in the past, I think we have seen a gradual evolution over the last 2 years towards a more economic dimension. And in fact, I would argue that it is the economic dimension which is now becoming a primary area of importance of SCO. That, of course, means that for the European Union, which also aspires to promote regional cooperation, SCO is becoming more important. The second issue why SCO is important is because SCO now is more interested and has a greater competence in the energy sphere. And of course, as the SCO includes one of the biggest producers of energy in the world, namely Russia and Kazakhstan, as well as other Central Asian states, of course, Uzbekistan. And as we know, in the next summit, which will take place in a few weeks, Turkmenistan will be for the first time participating, and possibly there are expectations, at least in many of the SCO capitals, that it might join in the future. If that indeed will be possible, we will see SCO uniting one of the key energy producers in the world. Also, of course, SCO has one of the biggest energy consumers in the world, namely China and India, as well as, of course, Pakistan and possibly in the future, you know, other regional powers. And that means that if European Union is serious, and I think it has been for a long time, to develop not only dependency on Russia as a key supplier, but also on Central Asia, it will have to talk with SCO as well as a framework for a comprehensive dialogue on energy in which the issues of long-term energy relationship has to be discussed. There is also, of course, importance of SCO for the EU is because Russia and China are members, and for the European Union, both of those countries remain to be important in their foreign policy. It is also important that SCO tackles the security issues, which are also one of the top priorities on the European security and defense policy agenda, such as, for example, the problems of drug trafficking originating from Afghanistan, the issues of growing Islamic extremism and radicalism, the issues of terrorism and soft security threats, such as organized crime and border security. All of those issues are important for the EU. So what are the limitations, of course, on the future relationship between EU and SCO? And as I mentioned at the beginning, it is still very much an aspiring partnership, and we are not yet sure whether this dialogue, although there are lots of opportunities for that, in fact is going to take place. I will focus here on two issues. One is I would want to sort of touch upon what are the kind of myths and, I would say, misinterpretations of SCO that still exist in the West. And secondly, what are the real limitations on the development of relationship between Europe and SCO. The misinterpretations, I will say, fall within three main areas, and Professor Iwashita in his introductory remarks have already mentioned some of them. But the first perception of SCO that has been prevalent, I would say, after the 9/11, is that SCO has been primarily created to push the West out of Central Asia. And of course, we all remember the famous Astana Summit Declaration, which specifically mentioned the need for NATO countries and United States, in particular, to withdraw its troops from Central Asia. It was a very harshly worded declaration. We also remember how Uzbekistan, shortly after joining the SCO, has asked the United States to close down its bases in Central Asia. However, despite of all the strong rhetoric which we have seen in a number of the SCO declarations, the realities on the ground is quite different. In fact, most of the SCO member states are developing very active and vibrant relationship with the West, with NATO members, with the coalition members in the area of security. Kazakhstan, which is one of the key members of the SCO, has now individual partnership and cooperation program with NATO, IPAP. Kyrgyzstan has been developing a very active relationship with NATO, as well as hosting the biggest military base. Even Uzbekistan, which closed down the U.S. military base, in fact still provides facilities for German armed forces, which are based in Termez and operate out of Termez for their operations in Afghanistan. And of course, Tajikistan is also offering a number of facilities for the use of coalition forces. The second misinterpretation of SCO is that it is essentially a bloc which has been dominated by Russia and China, and that the Central Asian states actually are just subject in this relationship. And that, I think, is also a big misinterpretation. I think Central Asian states themselves are increasingly influential And increasingly, not the demandeurs, but actually the ones who are determining the SCO agenda. For example, in the forthcoming summit, which will take place in a couple of weeks, a very active diplomatic process is now underway, in which a number of decisions that were projected to be approved in the summit will not be approved because of the opposition by a number of Central Asian states. And I would argue that it is increasingly Central Asian states themselves that are defining their agenda of SCO. And finally, the third misinterpretation is that the SCO is simply a club of dictators that is only staying together in order to protect themselves from the inevitable, that is the arrival of democracy in Central Asia. And that relationship with SCO will be detrimental for any democracy promotion policies that the West might have in Central Asia. That is also a myth. I think, yes, of course, SCO, I would argue, as many other Asian institutions like ASEAN or other institutions, have a basic principle of non-interference in their domestic affairs as very much core principle in their activity. However, despite of the a lot of rhetoric surrounding the concerns about so-called color revolutions, the SCO has never directly interfered with any activities of or any agendas that related to democracy promotion in the region. So since the time is running out, I will try to to be brief in the next 5 minutes of actually trying to outline what are the real limitations from my point of view on the relationship between Europe and SCO, and what are the key issues on which this relationship should be focused. First, the real limitations. There are a number of real limitations beyond those slogans that I mentioned before. The first limitation is that the Central Asian states themselves are still inherently weak. We still are seeing practically, I would say, even in all SCO member states, including Russia and China, the process of nation building is still underway. It is very far from being finished. And as such, it is very hard to know, of course, in the long run, how this nation-building process is going to develop and whether it will be inducive or conducive for the future integration within SCO. Therefore, I think it is until this process is some ways finished, I think it's hard for us to know whether SCO will be there in the next 10 or 15 years. The second issue that SCO lacks is supranational institutions, which of course are incredibly important for the European Union, which again limit the possibilities for the further integration within SCO area, particularly if we are talking about creating a more integrated economic area. And of course, you know, SCO is talking about developing common market and greater integrated trade area. There's also, of course, the issue of internal contradictions within SCO, and most primarily the rivalry between Russia and China, which in some ways has been contained, I would argue, within the SCO, but it remains there anyway. And this rivalry is first and foremost now manifests itself in the way how Russia and China have two different visions on the future of SCO, Russia very much emphasizing the need for keeping security dimension as the key identity of SCO, while China, of course, is now more and more pushing towards making SCO mainly an economic player. Other issues, of course, relate to the issues of democracy and human rights in the Central Asian states, and in fact in all SCO member states, including Russia and China. European Union, as a multilateral player, of course, cannot focus simply on interests in relationship with Central Asian states or SCO states. The issue of common values or promotion of common values has to be part of the agenda, as it is, and of course, in the relationship between European Union and Russia, which, of course, is developing in a rather difficult way, as you all know. So how to marry the need for strategic dialogue on such important interests as energy security, terrorism, with the need to develop a real understanding on the issues of human rights and democracy, and whether the SCO member states will be open for such dialogue. But there is no doubt that the European Union will not be prepared to enter in any dialogue with SCO unless those issues are on the agenda. So what are now the possible areas for cooperation? I will sum up just in the remaining 2 minutes. There are a number of very key issues that can be put on the EU-SCO agenda in whatever form this cooperation will take place. And actually, I think that there are a number of possibilities for choosing formats. We are unlikely to see any institutional links between EU and SCO in the form of joint memorandum or association agreement. That is too early to say about this. But we can see, for example, such forms as a special conference on which EU member states and SCO member states could attend, or some summit on the fringes of the SCO summit, or possibly some ad hoc process of consultations and senior visits, which of course has taken place already. So I would argue that there are five different topics that could be put on the agenda. The first topic, of course, is economic development of Central Asia. The European Union, as I mentioned, is planning to commit an increasing amount of economic resources towards development in Central Asia. There is no need to see duplication, and there is real need to see the way how SCO economic project and the projects and the European initiatives can be mutually reinforcing. The second issue, of course, is the issues of soft security. That is particularly the problem of drug trafficking out of Afghanistan, the issues of corruption and organized crime, the issues of border security, and such sensitive issues as use of water resources in Central Asia. All of those issues can be discussed. And as you know, SCO has a special structure based in Uzbekistan, Regional Anti-Terrorist Center, which can be a natural place where such discussions can take place. There has to be, I think, a special discussion on Afghanistan itself. I think there is a growing concern in Central Asia now of recent trends within Afghanistan, where the instability, which has manifested itself particularly strongly in the south, is now increasingly spreading towards the north. And of course, there is a concern in Central Asian countries, naturally, that should the ISAF decide to withdraw, which I would say cannot be excluded in a 5 to 10 year time frame, and should the instability in Afghanistan escalate, how the Central Asian states can be should be dealing with this problem. But there also need to be discussions about what role Central Asian states can play constructively in promoting stability and development in Afghanistan. Another issue, as I mentioned, there should be a dialogue between the EU and SCO on energy security matters. And finally, again, to emphasize last but not least, a special dialogue on human rights, good governance, and democracy development in the region. So to conclude, I think it is too early to say, of course, whether there will be partnership between European Union and SCO. I would argue in my presentation today that there is compelling and growing rationale of why this partnership is important and should be pursued. At the same time, there are real limitations that one should acknowledge and develop this dialogue and partnership, keeping those limitations in mind. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You cover lots of most of the measure ground and in a limited time. Thank you very much.